Clear! Clear!
On entering the shooting room, John saw all the targets perforated in the heads, as before. Ding and Eddie were with the hostages, covering them with their armored bodies, weapons trained on the cardboard targets, which in real life would be on the floor and bleeding explosively from their shattered skulls.
"Excellent," Stanley pronounced. "Good improvisation. You, Tomlinson, you were slow, but your shooting was bloody perfect. You too, Vega."
"Okay, people, let's head over to the office to see the instant replay," John told them, heading outside and still shaking his head to clear his ears from the insult of the flashbangs. He'd have to get ear protectors and goggles if he did much more of this, lest his hearing be permanently damaged, even though he felt it his duty to experience the real thing, to be able to appreciate how everything worked. He grabbed Stanley on the walk over.
"Fast enough, Al?"
"Yes."
Stanley nodded.
"The flashbangs give us, 3 to 5 seconds of incapacitation, and another 15 or so of subnormal performance. Chavez adapted well. The hostages would all have survived, probably. John, our lads are right on the crest of the wave. They cannot get any better. Tomlinson, bad leg and all, didn't lose more than half a step, if that much. And our little Frenchman moves like a bloody mongoose. Even Vega, big as he is, isn't the least bit oafish. John, these lads are as good as any team I've ever seen."
"Well, I agree, but still so much is in the hands of our adversaries."
"Yes, I know, but God help the bastards when we come for them."
Chapter 13 Amusement. Popoff was still trying to learn more about his employer, but finding nothing to enlighten himself. The combination of the New York Public Library and the Internet had turned up reams of information, but nothing that gave the slightest clue as to why he'd employed the former KGB officer to dig up terrorists and turn them loose upon the world. It was as likely that a child would conspire a murder plot against a loving parent. It wasn't the morality of the event that troubled him. Morality had little place in intelligence operations. As a trainee at the KGB Academy outside Moscow, the subject had never come up, except insofar as he and his classmates had always been given to understand that the state was never wrong. "You will occasionally be ordered to do things you may find personally upsetting," Colonel Romanoff had said once. "Such things will be done, because the reasons, unknown to you or not, will always be the proper ones. You do have the right to question something for tactical reasons. As the officer in the field, how you do the mission will generally be your affair. But to refuse an assignment is not acceptable." And that had been that. Neither Popoff nor his classmates had even made notes on the issue. It was understood that orders were orders. And so, once he accepted employment, Popoff had done the jobs assigned. But as a servant of the Soviet Union, he'd always known the overall mission, which was to get vital information to his country, because his country needed the information either for itself or to assist others whose actions would be of real benefit to his country. Even dealing with Ilyich Ramirez Sanchez, Popoff had thought at the time, had served some special interest. He knew better now, of course. Terrorists were like wild dogs or rabid wolves that one tossed into someone's back garden just to create a stir. And yes, perhaps that had been strategically useful, or had been thought so by his masters, in the service of a state now dead and gone. But no, the missions had not really been useful, had they? And as good as KGB had once been, he still thought them the best espionage agency the world had ever seen, it had ultimately been a failure. The party for which the Committee for State Security had been the sword and shield was no more. The sword had not slain the party's enemies, and the shield had not protected against the West's various weapons. And so, had his superiors really known what they'd needed to do? Probably not, Popoff admitted to himself. And because of that, perhaps every mission he'd been assigned had been to some greater or lesser degree a fool's errand. The realization would have been a bitter one,
except that his training and experience were paying off now with a lavish salary, not to mention the 2 suitcases of cash he'd managed to steal. But for doing what? Getting terrorists killed off by European police forces? He could just as easily, if not so profitably, have fingered them to the police and allowed them to be arrested, tried, and imprisoned like the criminal scum they were, which would actually have been far more satisfying. A tiger in a cage, pacing back and forth behind his bars and waiting for his daily 5 kilos of chilled horse meat, was far more entertaining than one stuffed in a museum, and just as helpless. He was some sort of Judas goat, Dmitri Arkadyevich thought, but if so, serving what sort of abattoir? The money was good. Several more missions like the first 2, and he could take his money, his false identity papers, and vanish from the face of the earth. He could lie on some beach, drinking tasty beverages and watching pretty girls in skimpy bathing suits, or what? Popov didn't know exactly what sort of retirement he could stomach, but he was certain he could find something. Maybe use his talents to trade in stocks and bonds like a real capitalist, and thus spend his time enriching himself further. Perhaps that, he mused, sipping his morning coffee and staring out the window, looking south toward Wall Street. But he wasn't quite ready for that life yet, and until he was, the fact that he didn't know the nature of his mission's purpose was troublesome. In not knowing, he couldn't evaluate all the dangers to himself. But for all his skill, experience, and professional training, he hadn't a clue as to why his employer wanted him to let the tigers from their cages, out in the open where the hunters were waiting. What a pity, Popov thought, that he couldn't just ask. The answer might even be amusing. Check-in at the hotel was handled with mechanical precision. The reception desk was huge, and crowded with computers that raced electronically to get the guests checked in, the quicker to get them spending money in the park itself. Juan took his card key and nodded his thanks to the pretty female clerk, then hoisted his bags and headed off to his room, grateful that there were no metal detectors here. The walk was a short one, and the elevators unusually large, to accommodate people in wheelchairs, he imagined. 5 minutes later, he was in his room unpacking. He'd just about finished when a knock came at the door.
"Bonjour."
It was René. The Frenchman came in and sat on the bed, stretching as he did so. "Are you ready, my friend?" he asked in Spanish. "Sí," the Basque replied. He didn't look especially Spanish. His hair was on the red side of strawberry blonde, his features handsome, and his beard neatly trimmed. Never arrested by the Spanish police, he was bright, careful, but thoroughly dedicated, with 2 car bombings and a separate murder to his credit. This, René knew, would be Juan's boldest mission. But he looked ready enough, tense, a little edgy perhaps, but coiled like a spring and prepared to play his role. René, too, had done this sort of thing before, most often murders right on crowded streets. He'd walk right up to his target, fire a suppressed pistol, and just walk on normally, which was the best way to do it, since you were almost never identified. People never saw the pistol and rarely noticed a person walking normally down the Champs-Élysées. And so you just changed your clothes and switched on the television to see the press coverage of your work. Action Direct had been largely, but not quite completely, broken up by the French police. The captured men had kept faith with their at-large comrades, hadn't fingered or betrayed them, despite all the pressure and the promises of their uniformed countrymen. And perhaps some of them would be released as a result of this mission, though the main objective was to release their comrade Carlos. It would not be easy to get him out of La Sante, René thought, rising to look out the window at the train station used by people going to the park, but he saw the children there, waiting for their ride in. There were some things that no government, however brutal, could overlook. 2 buildings away, Jean-Paul was looking out at the same scene and contemplating much the same thoughts. He'd never married and had rarely even enjoyed a proper love affair. He knew now, at 43, that this had created a hole in his life and his character, an abnormality that he'd tried to fill with political ideology, with his beliefs in principles and his vision of a radiant socialist future for his country and for Europe, and ultimately for the whole world. But a niggling part of his character told him that his dreams were mere illusions, and that reality was before him, 3 floors down and 100 meters west, in the distant faces of children waiting to board the steam train to the park. But no, such thoughts were aberrations. Jean-Paul and his friends knew the rightness of their cause and their beliefs. They discussed them at the greatest length over the years, and concluded that their path was the right one. They'd shared their frustration that so few understood. But someday they would understand. Someday they would see the path of justice that socialism offered the entire world, would understand that the road to the radiant future had to be paved by the revolutionary elite who understood the meaning and force of history. And they wouldn't make the mistakes the Russians had made, those backward peasants in that overlarge, foolish nation. And so he was able to look down on the assembled people, as they tightened up at the platform while the steam whistle announced the coming of the train, and see things. Even the children were not people, really, but political statements to be made by others. People like himself who understood how the world actually worked, or how it should work. Would work, he promised himself, someday. Mike Dennis always took his lunch outside, a habit he'd formed in Florida. One thing he liked about World Park was that you could have a drink here, in his case, a nice red Spanish wine, which he sipped from a plastic cup as he watched how people circulated, and looked for goofs of one kind or another. He found no obvious ones. The walkways had been laid out after careful and thorough planning, using computer simulations. The rides here were the things that drew people most of all, and so the walkways had been planned to lead people to the more spectacular of them. The big expensive ones were pretty spectacular. His own kids loved to ride them, especially the dive bomber, a top-hanging coaster that looked fit to make a fighter pilot lose his lunch, next to which was the time machine, a virtual reality ride that accommodated 96 guests per 7-minute cycle. Any longer and some patrons could get violently ill, tests had shown. Out of that, and it was time for some ice cream or a drink. And there were concessions planted right there to answer the cravings. Farther away was Pepe's, an excellent sit-down restaurant specializing in Catalonian cuisine. You didn't put restaurants too close to the rides. Such attractions were not complimentary, since watching the dive bomber didn't exactly heighten the appetite, and for adults, neither did riding it. There was a science and an art to setting up and operating theme parks like this one, and Mike Dennis was one of the handful of people in the world who knew how it was done, which explained his enormous salary and the quiet smile that went with his sips of wine as he watched his guests enjoy the place. If this was work, then it was the best job in the world. Even the astronauts who rode the space shuttle didn't have this sort of satisfaction. He got to play with his toy every day. They were lucky to fly twice in a year. His lunch completed, Dennis rose and walked back toward his office on Strada España, the Spanish main street, the central spoke on the partial wheel. It was another fine day at World Park, the weather clear, the temperature 21 Celsius, the air dry and pure. The rain in Spain did not, in his experience, stay mainly in the plain. The local climate was much like California's, which, he reflected, went just fine with the Spanish language of the majority of his employees. On the way, he passed one of the park security people. Andre, the name tag said, and the language tag on the other shirt pocket said he spoke Spanish, French, and English. Good, Dennis thought. They didn't have enough people like that. The meeting place was prearranged. The dive bomber ride used as its symbol the German Ju-87 Stuka, complete to the Iron Cross insignia on the wings and fuselage, though the swastika on the tail had been thoughtfully deleted. It ought to have greatly offended Spanish sensibilities, Andre thought. Did no one remember Guernica, that first serious expression of Nazi Schrecklichkeit, when thousands of Spanish citizens had been massacred? Was historical appreciation that shallow here? Evidently it was. The children and adults in line frequently reached out to touch the half-scale model of the Nazi aircraft that had dived on both soldiers and civilians with its Trumpet of Jericho siren. The siren was replicated as part of the ride itself, though on the 150-meter first hill, the screams of the riders, as often as not, drowned it out, followed by the compressed air explosion and fountain of water at the bottom when the cars pulled out through simulated flak bursts for the climbing loop into the second hill after dropping a bomb on a simulated ship. Was he the only person in Europe who found the symbology here horrid and bestial? Evidently so. People raced off the ride to rejoin the line to ride it again, except for those who bumbled off to recover their equilibrium, sometimes sweating, and twice he'd seen to vomit. A clean-up man with a mop and bucket stood by for that. Not the choicest job in World Park. The medical aid post was a few meters farther away, for those who needed it. Andre shook his head. It served the bastards right to feel ill after choosing to ride that hated symbol of fascism. Jean-Paul, René, and Juan appeared almost together, close to the entrance of the time machine, all sipping soft drinks. They and the five others were marked by the hats they'd bought at the entrance kiosk. Andre nodded to them, rubbing his nose as planned. René came over to him. "Where is the men's room?" he asked in English. "Follow the signs," Andre pointed. "I get off at 18 hours. Dinner as planned?" "Yes." "All are ready?" "Entirely ready, my friend." "Then I will see you at dinner." Andre nodded and walked off, continuing his patrol as he was paid to do, while his comrades walked about, some taking the time to enjoy the rides, he imagined. The park would be even busier tomorrow, he'd been told at the morning briefing session. Another 9,000-plus would be checking into the hotels tonight or tomorrow morning in preparation for the bank holiday weekend in this part of Europe, for Good Friday. The park was set up for mobs of people, and his fellow security personnel had told him all manner of amusing stories about the things that happened here. 4 months earlier, a woman had delivered twins in the medical post 20 minutes after riding the dive bomber, much to her husband's surprise and the delight of Dr. Weiler. The children had been awarded lifetime passes to World Park on the spot, which had made the local TV news, part of the park's genius for public relations. "Maybe she'd name the boy Troll," Andre snorted, as he spotted one ahead. The trolls were short-leg, massive-head costumes worn by petite females, he'd learned on coming to work. You could tell by the skinny legs that fitted into the huge feet shoes they wore. There was even a water supply in the costume to make the monstrous lips drool. And over there was a Roman legionnaire dueling comically with a Germanic barbarian. One of them would alternately run from the other, usually to the applause of the people sitting down to watch the spectacle. He turned to walk over to the German Strasse, and was greeted by the oompa music of a marching band. Why didn't they play the Horst Wessel lead? Andre wondered. It would have gone well with the damned green Stuka. Why not dress the band in SS black? Maybe have compulsory shower baths for some of the guests. Wasn't that part of European history, too? Damn this place, Andre thought. The symbology was designed to incur the rage of anyone with the most rudimentary political awareness. But no, the masses had no memory, no more than they had any understanding of political and economic history. He was glad they'd chosen this place to make their political statement. Maybe this would get the idiots to think, just a little bit, perhaps, about the shape of the world. The misshape, Andre corrected himself, allowing himself a very un-World Park frown at the sunny day and smiling crowds. There, he told himself, that was the spot. The children loved it. There was a crowd of them there even now, dragging, pulling the hands of their parents, dressed in their shorts and sneakers, many wearing hats, with helium-filled balloons tied to their little wrists. And there was a special one, a little girl in a wheelchair, wearing the special wish button that told every ride attendant to allow her on without the need to stand in line. A sick one, Dutch from the style of her parents' dress, Andre thought, probably dying from cancer, sent here by some charity or other modeled on the American Make-A-Wish Foundation, which paid for the parents to bring their dying whelp here for one first and last chance to see the trolls and other cartoon characters, their rights licensed to World Park for sale and other exploitation. How brightly their sick little eyes shone here, Andre saw, on their quick road to the grave, and how solicitous the staff was to them. As though that mattered to anyone, this bourgeois sentimentality upon which the entire park was founded. Well, they'd see about all that, wouldn't they? If there were ever a place to make a political statement, to bring the attention of all Europe and all the world to what really mattered, this was it. Ding finished his first pint of beer. He'd have only one more. It was a rule that no one had written down and that no one had actually enforced, but by common agreement, nobody on the teams had more than two at a time while the teams were on call, as they almost always were. And besides, two pints of Brit beer were quite a lot, really. Anyway, all the members of Team 2 were home having dinner with their families. Rainbow was an unusual outfit in that sense. Every soldier was married, with a wife and at least one kid. The marriages even appeared to be stable. John didn't know if that was a mark of special operations troopers, but these two-legged tigers who worked for him were pussycats at home, and the dichotomy was both amazing and amusing to him. Sandy served the main course, a fine roast beef. John rose to get the carving knife so that he could do his duty. Patsy looked at the huge hunk of dead steer and thought briefly about mad cow disease, but decided that her mother had cooked the meat thoroughly. Besides, she liked good roast beef, cholesterol and all, and her mom was the world's champ at making gravy. "How's it going at the hospital?" Sandy asked her physician daughter. "OB is pretty routine. We haven't had a single hard one in the last couple of weeks. I've kind of hoped for a placenta previa, maybe even a placenta abrupta to see if we have the drill down, but—" "Oh, don't wish for those, Patsy. I've seen them happen in the ER. Total panic. And the OB better have his act together, or things can go to hell in a New York minute. Dead mother and a dead child." "Ever see that happen, Mom?" "No, but I've seen it come close to that twice in Williamsburg. Remember Dr. O'Connor?" "Tall, skinny guy, right?" "Yeah," Sandy nodded. "Thank God he was on duty for the second one. The resident came unglued, but Jimmy came in and took over. I was sure we'd lose that one."
"Well, if you know what you're doing."
"If you know what you're doing, it's still tense. Routine is fine with me. I've done ER duty too long," Sandy Clark went on. "I love a quiet night when I can get caught up on my reading." "Voice of experience," John Clark observed, serving the meat. "Makes sense to me," Domingo Chavez agreed, stroking his wife's arm. "How's the little guy?"
"Kicking up a storm right now," Patsy replied, moving her husband's hand to her belly.
It never failed, she saw. The way his eyes changed when he felt it. Always a warm, passionate boy, Ding just about melted when he felt the movement in her womb.
"Baby," he said quietly.
"Yeah," she smiled. "Well, no nasty surprises when the time comes, okay?" Chavez said next. "I want everything to go routinely. This is exciting enough. Don't want to faint or anything."
"Right," Patsy laughed. "You? Faint? My commando?"
"You never know, honey," her father observed, taking his seat. "I've seen tough guys fold before."
"Not this one, Mr. C," Domingo noted with a raised eyebrow.
"More like a fireman," Sandy said from her seat.
the way you guys just hang around till something happens.
That's true, Domingo agreed.
And if the fire never starts, it's okay with us.
You really mean that? Patsy asked.
Yes, honey, her husband told her. Going out isn't fun. We've been lucky so far. We haven't lost a hostage.
But that'll change, Rainbow Six told his subordinate.
Not if I have anything to say about it, John.
Ding, Patsy said, looking up from her food.
Have you actually...
The look answered the question, though the words were, "Let's not talk about that."
We don't carve notches in our guns, Pats, John told his daughter. Bad form, you see.
Noonan came over today, Chavez went on. Says he's got a new toy to look at.
What's it cost? John asked, first of all.
Well, not much, he says, not much at all. Delta just started looking at it.
What's it do?
It finds people.
Huh? Is this classified?
Commercial product, and no, it's not classified at all, but it finds people.
How?
Tracks the human heart up to 500 meters away.
What?
Patsy asked. How's it do that?
Well, not sure, but Noonan says the guys at Fort Bragg are going nuts. I mean, real enthusiastic about it. It's called Lifeguard or something like that.
Anyway, he asked the headquarters snake people to send us a demo team.
We'll see, John said, buttering his roll.
Great bread, Sandy.
It's that little bakery on Millstone Road. Isn't the bread wonderful over here?
And everybody knocks Brit food, John agreed. The idiots? Just what I was raised with.
All this red meat, Patsy worried aloud.
My cholesterol is under 170, honey, Ding reminded her. Lower than yours.
I guess it's all that good exercise.
Wait until you get older, John groused.
He was nudging 200 for the first time in his life, exercise and all.
No hurry here, Ding chuckled.
Sandy, you are still one of the best cooks around.
Thanks, Ding.
Just so our brains don't rot from eating this English cow.
A Spanish grin.
Well, this is safer than ziplining out of the Nighthawk. George and Sam are still hurtin'. Maybe we ought to try different gloves.
Same ones the SAS uses, I checked.
Yeah, I know. I talked it over with Eddie day four yesterday. He says we have to expect training accidents, and Homer says the Delta loses a guy a year, dead, in training accidents.
What?
Alarm from Patsy.
And Noonan says the FBI lost a guy once, zipping down from a Huey.
Hand just slipped.
Oops.
Team 2 lead shrugged.
Only security against that is more training, John agreed.
Well, my guys are right at the proper edge. Now I have to figure a way to keep them right there without breaking it.
That's the hard part, Domingo. I suppose. Chavez finished his plate.
What do you mean, the edge? Patsy asked.
Honey, I mean Team 2 is lean and mean. We always were, but I don't see us getting any better than we are now. Same with Peter's bunch. Except for the two injuries, there isn't room for any improvement I can see, especially with Malloy on the team now. Damn, he knows how to drive a chopper.
Ready to kill people? Patsy asked dubiously.
It was hard for her to be a physician, dedicated to saving life, and yet be married to a man whose purpose often seemed to be the taking of it. And Ding had killed someone, else he wouldn't have suggested that she not think about it. How could he do that, and still turn to mush when he felt the baby inside her? It was a lot for her to understand, much as she loved her diminutive husband with the olive skin and flashing white smile.
No, honey. Ready to rescue people, he corrected her. That's the job.
But how sure can we be that they will let them out? Esteban asked. What choice will they have? Jean-Paul replied. He poured the carafe of wine into the empty glasses.
"I agree," Andre said. "What choice will they have? We can disgrace them before the world. And they are cowards, are they not, with their bourgeois sentimentality? They have no strength, not as we do."
"Others have made the mistake of believing that," Esteban said, not so much playing devil's advocate as voicing worries that they all had to have, to one extent or another. And Esteban had always been a worrier.
"There has never been a situation like this. The Guardia Civil is effective, but not trained for a situation like this one."
"Policemen," Andre snorted.
"That is all. I do not think they will arrest any of us, will they?"
That remark earned him a few smirks. It was true. They were mere policemen, accustomed to dealing with petty thieves, not dedicated political soldiers, men with the proper arms and training and dedication.
"Did you change your mind?"
Esteban bristled.
"Of course not, comrade. I simply counsel objectivity when we evaluate the mission. A soldier of the revolution must not allow himself to be carried away by mere enthusiasm."
Which was a good cover for his fears, the others thought. They all had them, the proof of which was their denial of that fact.
"We'll get Ilyich out," René announced. "Unless Paris is willing to bury 100 children, that they will not do. And some children will get to fly to Lebanon and back as a result. On that we are agreed, are we not?"
He looked around the table and saw all 9 heads nod.
"Bien. Only the children need foul their underpants for this, my friends, not us."
That turned the nods into smiles, and to discreet laughs, as the waiters circulated around the restaurant. René waved for some more wine. The selection was good here, better than he could expect in an Islamic country for the next few years, as he dodged DGSE's field intelligence officers, hopefully with more success than Carlos had enjoyed. Well, their identities would never be known. Carlos had taught the world of terrorism an important lesson. It did not pay to advertise. He scratched his beard. It itched, but in that itching was his personal safety for the next few years.
"So, Andre, who comes tomorrow?"
"Thompson, CSF, is sending 600 employees and their families here. A company outing for one of their departments."
"It could not be better," the security guard told them.
Thompson was a major French arms manufacturer. Some of the workers, and therefore their children, would be known and important to the French government. French and politically important. No, it could not get much better than that.
"They will be moving about as a group. I have their itinerary. They come to the castle at noon for lunch and a show. That is our moment, my friends."
Plus one other little addition Andre had decided on earlier in the day. They were always around somewhere, especially at the shows.
"D'accord?"
René asked the people around the table, and again got his nods. Their eyes were stronger now. Doubts would be set aside. The mission lay before them. The decision to undertake it was far behind. The waiter arrived with 2 new carafes, and the wine was poured around. The 10 men savored their drinks, knowing they might be the last for a very long time. And in the alcohol, they found their resolve.
"Don't you just love it?" Chavez asked.
"Only Hollywood. They hold their weapons like they're knives or something, and then they hit a squirrel in the left nut at 20 yards. Damn, I wish I could do that."
"Practice, Domingo," John suggested with a chuckle. On the TV screen, the bad guy flew about 4 yards backward as though he'd been hit with an anti-tank rocket instead of a mere 9mm pistol round.
"I wonder where you buy those."
"We can't afford them, oh great accounting expert."
John almost spilled his remaining beer at that one. The movie ended a few minutes later. The hero got the girl. The bad guys were all dead. The hero left his parent agency in disgust at their corruption and stupidity, and walked off into the sunset, content at his unemployment. Yeah, Clark thought, that was Hollywood.
With that comfortable thought, the evening broke up. Ding and Patsy went home to sleep, while John and Sandy did the same. It was all a big movie set, Andre told himself, walking into the park an hour before it opened to the guests already piling up at the main gate. How very American, despite all the effort that had gone into building the place as a European park. The whole idea behind it, of course, was American. That fool Walt Disney, with his talking mice and children's tales, that had stolen so much money from the masses. Religion was no longer the opiate of the people. No, today it was escapism to depart from the dull day-to-day reality they all lived and all hated, but which they couldn't see for what it was, the bourgeois fools. Who led them here? Their children with their shrill little demands to see the trolls and the other characters from Japanese cartoons, or to ride the hated Nazi Stuka. Even Russians, those who'd gotten enough money out of their shattered economy to throw it away here, even Russians rode the Stuka. Andre shook his head in amazement. Perhaps the children didn't have the education or memory to appreciate the obscenity, but surely their parents did. But they came here anyway. Andre? The park policeman turned to see Mike Dennis, the chief executive officer of World Park, looking at him.
Yes, Monsieur Dennis?
The name's Mike, remember? The executive tapped his plastic name tag. And yes, it was a park rule that everyone called everyone else by his Christian name. Something else doubtless learned from the Americans.
Yes, Mike. Excuse me.
You okay, Andre? You look a little upset about something.
I did?
No.
Mike, no, I'm fine. Just a long night for me.
Okay. Dennis patted him on the shoulder. Busy day planned. How long you been with us?
2 weeks.
Like it here?
It is a unique place to work.
That's the idea, Andre. Have a good one.
Yes, Mike.
He watched the American boss walk quickly away toward the castle and his office. Damned Americans. They expected everyone to be happy all the time, else something must be wrong. And if something went wrong, it had to be fixed. Well, Andre told himself, something was wrong, and it would be fixed this very day. But Mike wouldn't like that very much, would he? 1 kilometer away, Jean-Paul transferred his weapons from his suitcase to his backpack. He'd ordered room service to bring breakfast in, a big American breakfast, he'd decided, since it might have to stand him in good stead for most of this day, and probably part of another. Elsewhere in this hotel and other hotels in the same complex, the others would be doing the same. His Uzi submachine gun had a total of 10 loaded magazines, with 6 more spares for his 9mm pistol, and 3 fragmentation hand grenades in addition to his radio. It made for a heavy backpack, but he wouldn't be carrying it all day. Jean-Paul checked his watch and took one final look at his room. All the toiletries were recently bought. He'd wiped all of them with a damp cloth to make sure he left no fingerprints behind, then the table and desk tops, and finally his breakfast dishes and silverware. He didn't know if the French police might have his prints on file somewhere, but if so, he didn't want to give them another set. And if not, why make it easy for them to start a file? He wore long khaki trousers and a short-sleeve shirt, plus the stupid white hat he'd bought the previous day. It would mark him as just one more guest in this absurd place, totally harmless. With all that done, he picked up his backpack and walked out the door, taking a final pause to wipe the doorknob both inside and outside before walking to the elevator bank. He pressed the down button with a knuckle instead of a fingertip, and in a few seconds was on his way out the hotel door and walking casually to the train station,
where his room key card was his passport to the World Park transportation system. He took off the backpack to sit down, and found himself joined in the compartment by a German, also carrying a backpack, with his wife and two children. The backpack bumped loudly when the man set it on the seat next to him. "My minicam," the man explained, in English, oddly enough.
"I also. Heavy things to carry about, aren't they?"
"Ah, yes, but this way we will have much to remember from our day in the park."
"Yes, you will," Jean-Paul said in reply.
The whistle blew and the train lurched forward. The Frenchman checked his pocket for his park ticket. He actually had 3 more days of paid entry into the theme park. Not that he'd need it. In fact, nobody in the area would.
"What the hell?" John mumbled, reading the facts on the top of his pile. "Scholarship fund." And who had violated security? George Winston, Secretary of the Treasury. What the hell?
"Alice," he called.
"Yes, Mr. Clark," Mrs. Forgate said on coming into his office. "I rather thought that would cause a stir. It seems that Mr. Osterman feels it necessary to reward the team for rescuing him."
"What's the law on this?" John asked next.
"I haven't a clue, sir."
"How do we find out?"
"A solicitor, I imagine."
"Do we have a lawyer on retainer?"
"Not to my knowledge, and you will probably need one, a Briton and an American as well."
"Super," Rainbow Six observed. "Could you ask Alistair to come in?"
"Yes, sir."
Chapter 14 Sword of the Legion. The company outing for Thompson CSF had been planned for some months. The 300 children had been working overtime to get a week ahead in their schoolwork, and the event had business implications as well. Thompson was installing computerized control systems in the park. It was part of the company's transition from being mainly a military products producer to a more generalized electronics engineering firm. And here their military experience helped. The new control systems, with which World Park management could monitor activities throughout the establishment, were a linear development of data transfer systems developed for NATO ground forces. They were multilingual, user-friendly gadgets that transmitted their data through ether space rather than over copper landlines, which saved a few million francs. And Thompson had brought the systems in on time and on budget, which was a skill that they, like many defense contractors all over the globe, were struggling to learn. In recognition of the successful fulfillment of the contract to a high-profile commercial customer, senior Thompson management had cooperated with World Park to arrange this company picnic. Everyone in the group, children included, wore red T-shirts with the company logo on the front. And for the moment, they were mainly together, moving toward the center of the park in a group escorted by 6 of the park trolls, who were dancing their way to the castle with their absurdly large bare feet shoes and hairy head bodies. The group was further escorted by legionnaires, 2 wolfskin-wearing signifers bearing cohort standards, and the 1 lion-skinned aquilifer, carrying the gold eagle, the hallowed emblem of the 6th Legio Victrix, now quartered at World Park, Spain, as its antecedent had been under the Emperor Tiberius in 20 AD. The park employees tasked to be part of the resident legion had developed their own esprit, and took to their marching with a will. Their Spanish-made Spatha swords scabbarded awkwardly, but accurately, high up on their right sides, and their shields carried in their left hands. They moved in a group as proudly as their notional Victrix or Victorious Legion had once done 20 centuries before, their predecessors once the first and only line of defense for the Roman colony that this part of Spain had been. About the only thing the group didn't have was a coterie of people leading them with flags, which was mainly a Japanese affectation anyway. After the first day's ceremonies, the Thompson people would wander off on their own,
and enjoy their 4 days here as normal tourists. Mike Dennis watched the procession on his office TV monitors while he gathered his notes. The Roman soldiers were a signature item for his theme park, and for some reason or other had proven to be wildly popular, enough so that he'd recently increased their number from 50 to over 100 and established a trio of centurions to command them. You could spot them by the sideways plumes on their helmets instead of the fore and aft on the helms of the ordinary legionnaires. The guys in the outfit had taken to real sword practice, and it was rumored that some of the swords actually had edges, which Dennis hadn't bothered to verify, and which he'd have to put a stop to if he did. But anything that was good for employee morale was good for the park, and it was his practice to let his people run their departments with minimal interference from his command center in the castle. He used his computer mouse to zoom in on the approaching mob. They were about 20 minutes early, and that was... Oh, yeah, it was Francisco de la Cruz leading the parade. Francisco was a retired sergeant in the Spanish Army's paratroops, and the guy just grooved to leading parades and such, didn't he? Tough-looking old bastard, over 50, with burly arms and so heavy a beard, World Park allowed mustaches but not beards for its employees, that he had to shave twice a day. The little kids found him intimidating, but Francisco had a way of scooping them up like a bearish grandfather and putting them instantly at ease. The kids especially liked playing with his red horsehair plume. Dennis made a mental note to have lunch with Francisco sometime soon. He ran his little department well, and deserved some attention from topside. Dennis pulled the manila folder from his action tray. He had to give a welcoming speech to the Thompson guests, to be followed by music from one of the park's roving bands and a parade of the trolls, then dinner in the castle restaurant. He checked his watch and rose, heading for the corridor that led to a disguised passage with a secret door into the castle courtyard. The architects for this place had been handed a blank check, and they'd utilized the Gulf oil money well, though the castle wasn't totally authentic. It had fire escapes, sprinklers, and structural steel, not just blocks piled up and mortared together. "Mike," a voice called. The park manager turned. "Yeah, Pete? Telephone, it's the chairman calling." The executive turned and hustled back to his office, still clutching his prepared speech. Francisco, Pancho to his friends, De La Cruz, was not a tall man, only 5'7", but wide across the chest, and his pillar-like legs made the ground shake when he marched, stiff-legged, as an historian had told him was the custom of the legions. His iron helmet was heavy, and he could feel the flopping of the plume atop it. His left arm held the large and heavy scutum, the shield of the legionnaire that reached almost from neck to ankles, made of glue-laminated wood, but with a heavy iron boss in the center in the image of the Medusa, and metal edges. The Romans, he'd long since learned, had been tough soldiers to march into battle with this heavy gear, almost 60 pounds of it at full load with food and mess kit, about what he'd marched with as a soldier in the field. The park had duplicated all of it, though the quality of the metal was surely better than that which had been produced in the blacksmith shops of the Roman Empire. 6 young boys had formed up on him, emulating his heavy-footed march. De La Cruz liked that. His own sons were now in the Spanish army, following in their father's footsteps, just as these French boys were now doing. For De La Cruz, the world was in its proper shape. Only a few meters away, it was getting that way as well for Jean-Paul, René, and Esteban, the last of them with a cloud of balloons affixed to his wrist, selling one even now. The others were all wearing their white World Park hats, all getting into position around the crowd.
None of the terrorists were wearing the red Thompson shirts, though doing so would not have been all that difficult. Instead, they wore black World Park shirts to go with the hats, and all but Esteban and Andre were also wearing backpacks, like so many other visitors to World Park. The trolls had everyone in place a few minutes early, they all saw. The adults were joking among themselves, and the children pointing and laughing, their faces illuminated with joy that would soon change to something else, some racing around the taller adults, playing games of hide-and-seek within the crowd. And two were in wheelchairs. No, Esteban saw, they were not part of the Thompson group. They wore their special access buttons, but not the red shirts. Andre saw those guests, too. One was the little dying Dutch girl from the previous day, and one other. English by the look of his father, pushing the wheelchair up to the castle and through the crowd. Yes, they'd want both of those. So much the better that these two weren't French, wasn't it? Dennis had sat down at his desk. The call required detailed information that he'd had to call up on his computer. Yes, quarterly park revenues were 4.1% over projections. Yes, the slow season had turned out to be somewhat less slow than they'd expected. Unusually favorable weather, Dennis explained, was the explanation. And one couldn't count on that. But things were going smoothly, except for some computer problems on two of the rides. Yes, they had some software engineers in the back lot area working on that right now. Yes, there was warranty coverage from the manufacturer, and the manufacturer's representatives were being entirely cooperative. Well, they should, as they were bidding on two more mega-rides whose designs would make the entire world take a breathless step back, Dennis told the chairman, who hadn't seen the proposals yet, and would on his next trip to Spain in 3 weeks. They'd be doing TV shows about conception and design on these two, Dennis promised the chairman, especially for the American cable channel market. And wouldn't it be something if they increased their draw of American patrons, stealing guests from the Disney Empire, which had invented the theme park? The Saudi chairman, who'd initially invested in World Park because his children loved to ride things that he had trouble even looking at, was enthusiastic about the proposed new attractions, enough so that he didn't ask about them, willing to be surprised by Dennis when the time came. "What the hell?" Dennis said over the phone, looking up when he heard it. Everyone jumped at the noise, the shattering staccato of Jean-Paul's submachine gun, firing a long burst up into the air. In the castle courtyard, people turned and cringed instinctively at the same time, as they first saw the one bearded man aiming upward and swinging his weapon, which ejected a brief shower of brass cases into the air. Being untrained civilians, they did little for the first few seconds but look in shock, without even time to show real fear yet. And when they turned to see the shooter in their midst, those around him drawing instinctively away instead of trying to grab him, and the others withdrawing their weapons from their backpacks, at first just bringing them out without firing, waiting a beat or so. Francisco de la Cruz was standing behind one of the others, and saw the weapon coming out even before the first one fired. His brain recognized the unfriendly yet familiar shape of an Israeli Uzi 9mm submachine gun, and his eyes locked on it, reporting direction and distance, and that this was something that didn't belong in his park. The shock of the moment lasted only that long, and then his 20-plus years of uniformed service flashed into his consciousness, and 2 meters behind that bearded criminal, he started moving. Claude's eyes caught the movement, and he turned to see. What was this? A man wearing Roman armor and the strangest of headgear was moving toward him. He turned to face the threat, and Centurion de la Cruz acted on some sort of soldierly instinct that had transformed itself in time and place from the era to which his uniform belonged to where he was this noon. His right hand pulled the spatha from its scabbard, high up on his right side, and the shield came up, its center iron boss aimed at the muzzle of the Uzi as the sword came straight in the air. He'd had this sword custom made by a distant cousin in Toledo. It was formed of laminated carbon steel, just as the sword of El Cid had once been, and it had an edge fit to shave with, and he was suddenly a soldier again. And for the first time in his career, he had an armed enemy before him and a weapon in his hand, and the distance was less than 2 meters now, and gun or not, he was going to... Claude fired off a quick burst, just as he had learned so many times, into the center of mass of his advancing target. But that happened to be the 3-centimeter-thick iron boss of the scutum, and the bullets deflected off it, fragmenting as they did so. De La Cruz felt the impact of the fragments peppering his left arm, but the sting of insects would have felt worse as he closed, and his right sword arm came left, then right, slashing in a way the spatha was not designed for. But the razor's edge in the last 20 centimeters near the point did the rest, catching the cabron's upper arm and laying it open just below the end of the short sleeve. And for the first time in his life, Centurion Francisco de la Cruz drew blood in anger. Claude felt the pain. His right arm moved, and his finger depressed the trigger, and the long burst hit the oncoming shield low and right of the boss. 3 bullets hit De La Cruz's left leg, all below the knee, through the metal greaves, one of them breaking the tibia, causing the centurion to scream in pain as he went down, his second lethal slash of the sword missing the man's throat by a whisker. His brain commanded his legs to act, but he had only one working leg at the moment, and the other failed him utterly, causing the former paratrooper to fall to the left and forward. Mike Dennis ran to the window instead of using the TV monitors. Others were watching those, and the take from the various cameras was being recorded automatically in a bank of VCRs elsewhere in the park. His eyes saw, and though his brain didn't believe, it was there, and impossible as it was, it had to be real. A number of people with guns were surrounding the sea of red shirts, and they herded them now like sheepdogs inward and toward the castle courtyard. Dennis turned. "Security lockdown! Security lockdown now!" he called to the man on the master control board, and with a mouse click the castle's doors were all dead bolted. "Call the police," Dennis ordered next. That was also pre-programmed. An alarm system fired off a signal to the nearest police barracks. It was the robbery alert signal, but that would be sufficient for the moment. Dennis next lifted a desk phone and punched in the police number from the sticker on his phone. The one emergency contingency they'd planned for was a robbery of their cash room, and since that would necessarily be a major crime committed by a number of armed criminals, the park's internal response to the signal was also pre-programmed. All park rides would be stopped at once, all attractions closed, and shortly people would be instructed to return to their hotel rooms or to the parking lot, because the park was closing due to an unexpected emergency. The noise of the machine guns would have carried a long way, Dennis thought, and the park guests would understand the urgency of the moment. This was the amusing part, Andre thought. He donned a spare white hat from one of his comrades and took the gun that Jean-Paul had packed for him. A few meters away, Esteban cut the balloons loose from his hand, and they soared into the air as he, too, took up his weapon. The children were not as overtly frightened as their parents were, perhaps thinking that this also was one of the magic things to be expected at the park, though the noise hurt their little ears and had made them jump. But fear is contagious, and the children quickly saw that emotion in their parents' eyes, and one by one they held tight to hands and legs, looking about at the adults who were moving quickly now, around the red-shirted crowd, holding things that looked like guns. The boys recognized the shape from their own toys, which these clearly were not. Rene was in command. He moved toward the castle entrance, clear of the 9 others who were holding the crowd in place. Looking around, he could see others outside the perimeter of his group, looking in, many crouching down now, hiding, taking what cover there was. Many of them were taking pictures, some with television.